Welcome back to the Technology Whisperers with your host, myself, Sean Muller, and the illustrious Alistair Ross.
Illustrious.
At least I didn't say like notorious or something like that. Although maybe notorious would have fit better. We have a really exciting podcast for you, and I'm really looking forward to this. I'm going to hand it over to you, Alistair.
Oh, thank you very much, Sean. Yeah, definitely notorious is better than illustrious. But today I thought that we would, it's been one of these things I've been thinking about doing for a hot minute, and that is to do more story-based podcasts. I really think that everyone loves a good story, don't you, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people relate to the stories, and it makes us seem like more, and we are, real people, and that people can understand where it is we're coming from.
Yeah. So the whole point of this one really is to talk to the people who listen to this podcast who are perhaps in the middle of their journey of IT, but equally could also be starting out, or people who are in another trade and want to get into IT, but even people who are, you know, in a senior position but want to advance. So really, that's covering quite a lot.
Or even shift to a new track. But it might not even be that they want to advance. It may just be that they want to shift to another track. And to tie this into the theme of this, the Technology Whisperers, is this is really, what we're going to do is we're kind of going to demystify Alistair's journey around how he got to where he is. And so to help you have an understanding of the path that Alistair took that might be useful to you when it comes to decision making and the process for how he got to where he is.
Yeah. So I'm kind of going to label the story, like every good book at the opening page, it has its title, right? So yep. I'm going to label this story as the regret of saying no. All right. Now, before you start thinking I said no and then regretted it, it's probably the opposite. So what I want this story to give to you, if nothing else, is that if you say no to something, if an opportunity comes your way along your path, and it just happens to sit there right in front of you and it's presenting itself to you, then you have two options. You say yes or you say no. And if you say yes, you go down that path and you find out whatever that path does, wherever it may take you. It might be good, it might be not so good, but in the end, the difference between that and saying no is if you say no to something, which is, you know, a substantial opportunity, it's basically a gift staring in the eye, I would say. If you say no to it, then quite possibly we'll be going down the rest of your life going, what if? What if I took that opportunity 10 years ago? What if I did this instead of doing that? We've all been there, right? We've all had that moment in our lives where
several
we've
times.
Gone. Yeah. So I'm now in my 40s, and I think I've gotten to the point now where I recognize that there have been a few turning point moments in my life, and I've gone, I'm so glad I did that. And for me, I have the fortunacy to say I'm so glad I did that. But some people might be, there's a whole lot of reasons why you might make a decision for the negative. You might go, no, I don't want to do this. And that's okay. But here's a little story about my life, how I got into IT. So this will help you as well understand why people are motivated to get into IT, and then how the twists and turns will happen. Obviously, everybody's story is different, but this might give you some sort of, hopefully, inspiration, but hopefully just at least help you understand about those decisions being made. All right? So I guess where I'll start is when I was at school. And the reason I say why at school, because people are going, oh my goodness, how long have I got? The reason I start at school is because I wasn't a typical kid. Right, I wasn't a well-behaved boy, to say the least. I was always getting in trouble. I wasn't an A-grade student. In fact, when I got to fourth year, I was in Scotland. I'm Scottish. I grew up in Edinburgh. I also lived in Glasgow for a while, but lived in Edinburgh. And by the fourth year of high school, so I was about just coming up about 16. Basically, the school said, we don't want you to come back. Don't come back and darken our doors. But up until then, I had this, I was kind of socially okay. I was a little bit awkward, but generally nobody gave me too much of a hard time. So I had this persona that, you know, I had to be a cool kid, you know, and please people and all this sort of stuff. And this is sort of stuff I found out many years later that I didn't give a rat's ass about. But at the time, I found these things really important. So I wanted to stay the cool kid, right?
Yeah,
so it's very important that I didn't let all the cool kids know that I had a thing for computers. I was into computers. So I did that at home and I watched the movie War Games. And that was like that was the thing that I just loved. I loved this David Lightman character and he hacked into, you know, the NORAD, the US defense, and, you know, did all this cool stuff with computers. And that movie came out in 1983, right? But it's still like, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but it's actually quite a good movie. It still kind of holds up today. It's mental.
The technology obviously has moved on quite significantly, but the movie itself actually holds up really well.
Yeah, it's a good story. So there was that, and I kind of had this thing for this love of computers in the background, but I also loved DJing as well. So that was the thing that was socially acceptable at school. And then obviously I got into whole heaps of trouble and I was thrown out of school. And yeah, I basically went from there and I ended up getting kicked out of my house as well by my parents. They were like, you're a no good kid. And so all of a sudden I had to grow up really fast. So I was 16 years old. And so I had to get a flat. I got my own flat in Edinburgh City Centre. And, you know, this is crazy stuff. When you're 16 years old, all you want to do is like go out and drink and get in trouble and all the rest. But I really realized quickly that I had to pay the bills. Like, nobody was paying the rent for me and nobody was paying for a telephone line. And the telephone line for me was everything right then, because I was running what's called a bulletin board. And if you've never heard of a bulletin board, well, pre the World Wide Web, people didn't have, you know, things to get online with. Apart from, there was this thing that was kind of like a counterculture. It was kind of underground, and it was called a bulletin board. And I got in heaps of trouble with this, but it was also the best thing ever because I could talk to people online, and I had my online persona. And
you had to have a phone because people had
to have a phone.
People dialed into your bulletin board to get to update stuff and for you to update them.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'd share files.
It was the Facebook of the early 80s.
It was so much more than Facebook. I still look back on those days with fond memories. I actually made a documentary about it that I loved it that much, but I had so much fun. It was so formative.
We'll link to that documentary on YouTube. It is actually, I've watched it. Alistair has gotten some really good guests in the history of the bulletin board system. It's really worth watching. We'll make sure we link through to it.
Yeah, so it's one of these things that I guess if you weren't there at the time, you probably don't know anything about it. But it was really, really good fun. And it was, again, very formative. So War Games, the BBS, and all this stuff, getting in trouble and playing with MS-DOS, you know, the old PCs. It was, you know, green screen and all that sort of stuff. So why was this important? Because it was kind of shaping an interest in technology. And I think the interest in technology, for whatever type of technology it was, it wasn't really that important. It was the fact that I was interested in playing with things that was, you know, breaking them really and fixing them up and doing stuff with them that probably most people weren't. And I was still like pretty young. I started doing this sort of stuff when I was like 9 or 10. My dad bought a secondhand XT and you know, I was doing all this stuff, and I think that became a passion for me. It became almost overnight, that became a passion. And I think that has really been helpful for me for the rest of my entire life, because I didn't get into IT later on because I wanted money. I did it because I absolutely loved playing with all these gadgets. And once I got bored with one particular type of IT, one area in that, I went on to another area in IT and just kept learning and learning and learning. And so I got out of school and I did a few jobs and I decided to go to college because I needed to get a proper job, as I saw it at the time. And I got my diploma, and that's what you go to college. College in the UK or Scotland is slightly different to what New Zealand college is. It's like a sort of you know, sort of tertiary education sort of thing, right? And I did computing there, obviously, and interested in their Unix system, which was a SCO Unix system. And I found out what John the Ripper was. And all of a sudden, I managed to get into the password file, which was a non-shadow encrypted password file.
Oh, of course. Back then, yeah, nobody even thought about it.
So I just did this for shits and giggles, for no particular good reason other than it was seemed like a lot of fun. And so, yeah, I had, before long, I had a root access on the sysadmin access on the college computer, and I learned how to do that. Then I got bored with that and went on to do other things. And then I guess what happened next is I managed to get a job as a sysadmin. So I considered that my kind of first proper job. So I'd learned just enough about Unix so that I could go off and be a sysadmin for a company. That was an ISP. And there I learned a lot about Linux. Because Linux was just coming out around that.
Hold on, Alistair. You're gonna have to, you've used an acronym.
Oh yeah.
Define what an ISP is, because
Okay.
I mean, you and I know what it is, but we're demystifying it. So let's make sure that we help our listeners out with what an ISP is.
Yeah. So I got my first opportunity to work for a company who ISP, an internet service provider, and back in those days, I think they were on ISDN. So there's another acronym for you.
Yep.
Yeah, Internet Subscriber Digital Network, I think it stood for. That was one better than a dial-up modem, basically. So it was really slow, but so they were an ISP.
Yeah, back then the ISPs were the gateway to the internet. So you would dial, so America Online or CompuServe or most of the ISPs back in those days were universities. So you would dial into the university to get onto the internet in the U.S. So, yeah, that's what Alistair's talking about is basically the gateway, not what we consider today where it's a website and there's search engines and there's a whole other stuff. It really was just a series of phone numbers that you could dial to get onto the internet.
Mm, yeah. So that's what they did. And then they sort of pivoted their business to an ISP, a hosting company. And so we run Apache web servers and all that good stuff, IIS as well. And so I learned all those technologies really quickly, like just picked them up. Like I learned DNS and bind and, you know, Apache. And this was Apache 1, right? This is a long time ago. It was great fun. Really, really good fun. And I got opportunity to work for one of their clients. And so I moved over to them. And I was a consultant at that point. And I was going about clients in my three-piece suit in my first car, Edinburgh and all the rest. I thought I was the guy fixing up people's machines. And we were providing open source solutions. So Linux-based solutions. I would do Bacula backups and all sorts of stuff. It was really great time because you could use this new open source technology for all these sorts of bespoke solutions. And it was a lot, like it was so much fun because you were just creating stuff all the time.
Well, we were seeing the first, so what you're talking about is the late 90s, right? And we were seeing the first ramp up heading towards what eventually became the telecom bubble burst. But what we were seeing was a lot of investment that allowed for a lot of experimentation and doing stuff. I mean, if you've never seen it, at one point there were websites that had dancing babies and dancing Jesus on them, and they had all of this movement going on. But
the world was very different back then.
It was kind of a wild west. So if you were in technology at the time, you were getting to play around with a lot of new stuff that most of the companies hadn't seen before, and almost every brick and mortar company was looking at, well, how do I create a web presence?
It was a big deal. The web was everywhere. It was called surfing the web and the information superhighway, as Al Gore called it, right? So there was a whole bunch of this. A really exciting time to be involved. And I don't really feel like it's kind of the same anymore. Like it's different kind of excitement.
No, it's corporate. But it's corporate now. Back then, GeoCities.
Yeah.
You had little tiny companies and little tiny consultants, most of them working, like I said, out of universities in the US, but doing a whole lot of, and open source was just exploding.
Yeah.
And now we have moved on from that, and we're much more corporate centric. The corporations are driving most of the innovation that happens on the internet. We still have some open source community that are doing a lot of stuff, but back then it really was big time. I mean, Alistair mentioned IIS a minute ago, the internet web services. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From Microsoft was not considered to be an enterprise grade web server. I mean, Microsoft would have said back then it was, but, Tomcat and Apache were really the path for enterprise level web servers that people were looking at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was,
and they were free. They were open source versus Microsoft's expensive products.
Yeah.
That's what it is. We kind of take it for granted now, this open source world, but you know, back then this was something that was just amazing. And I got into writing software. I was writing websites and PHP and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, people might laugh at right now, but back in those days it was great. And Facebook itself was written on PHP and all the rest. I made a little website which was kind of like PHP. It was kind of like a Facebook, and it was before Facebook. I should have copyrighted it.
You should have.
Yeah. The Facebook. Yeah. No, my Facebook.
Oh, there you go. MySpace and Facebook in one. Yeah, you would have made a mint.
Yeah. Oh, so good. So yeah, then I decided I need to go off and get a degree because it's the right thing to do, right?
Yeah.
And so that was like, already you can see that my path to education and the path to getting into a career wasn't atypical. And I think that when I now look at hiring people, I look at people and I just base them on experience and also like what their attitude is. Very rarely do I go, you had to go to uni and do exactly this, because ultimately when I went to uni, I know that it was for the piece of paper. And whilst I did learn things there and it was a useful experience, you know, there are other ways that you can learn this. So if you don't have a uni experience, but have some other type of experience that equates to that experience, then that's absolutely fine. So I think there is quite a lot of hiring managers out there that do feel that way these days as well.
I think so too. I think if we look back 20 years ago, I think, and by the way, this is the way it is in a lot of other industries and a lot of other, you know, educational paths. But I think a lot of recruiters use the education. And by the way, in IT, they use certifications as shortcuts to trying to guess whether or not the candidate actually has the capability to do it. I'm in complete agreement with you. I tend to look for people with the capability to do the role, and then their attitude about how they approach it and how they're going to work with the team as being the two number one things. And then, you know, education can lead into their capability, but it's really about, do they have the capability to do it?
Yeah. So it was good for me. It was, education was like, well, it was network computing there. So I was learning like the subjects that I learned at uni was, it was the one of the guys, the leading authorities on this, like stuff that goes into the CCNA, the Cisco Certified Networking Associate exam, Dr. Bill Buchanan. He was my tutor actually in Edinburgh. And he's such a smart guy, really, really great guy. And so I did all my labs with him, and I did database systems. So I learned a lot more about Oracle that I had. I sort of knew MySQL and Postgres, but I didn't do Oracle. So I knew a bit more about relational databases from education, I guess. And then the rest of the stuff was stuff I already knew. So multitasking operating systems, real-time systems, all that sort of stuff. So when I came out of education, I think I was working in a PC store as well for part-time during the weekends or something like that. It was a lot of fun. But then after that, I came out and worked for GE Energy. And GE Energy was an interesting role because they was working on their real-time systems, their SCADA systems. And this is like the telemetry that works for your power systems, right? You know, your substations and all that sort of stuff. So I could basically had the back-end access to the red button that switches on and off power grids, which is a dangerous thing to let, what, a 19, 20-year-old me. But anyway, that was fine. Then I went off and worked on the data systems and the data center, for Amazon after that. And that was good as well. Did a lot bunch of Oracle and MySQL and Linux and more of that sort of stuff. And then I think came the next job, and that's where things really take a move for my career and what happened next. So I started there in this next company. It was called Pixel. And Pixel were a great company, and they were a multinational based out of Scotland. So they were in Malaysia and Korea and San Francisco and a few other places as well. So great, really great company that kind of built up over that dot-com bubble that you talked about, Sean,
right,
to be, you know, very, very popular very quickly. So those guys made Pinch to Zoom. You know, when we zoom in with our phones, you know,
yep,
they, you know, you zoom in, that they made that technology, and they made a product called Smart Office, which was the first office suite that worked on a phone. Now, if you think about it today, this is way before 2007 when the iPhone came out, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you think about it today, that's no big deal at all. Everybody's phone does that, right?
Yeah.
But back then, we didn't have the iPhone. We had Blackberries or something worse. And to have an office suite and something that you could zoom in really quickly with was a big deal. So they were making the software. So it was really cool. Anyway, I started off doing all the Linux.
By the way, Alistair, I actually had the software. Because I had a handspring.
Oh, yes, the Visor.
Running Palm OS, mm-hmm, a version of Palm OS, with a cell phone cartridge into the handspring. And I was actually in 2001, I was doing surveys in Arizona and was using the spreadsheet functionality within the handspring to be able to do stuff.
Far out. That's awesome. That's really cool. You know, I speak to a lot of people and they go, oh, I've never heard of that. But yeah, there you go. That's it. It was really innovative.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked very well.
It just worked. That was the brilliant part about it.
So what happened was I was doing their sort of Unix admin sort of stuff again, more of that sort of stuff. I was in your senior tech role, but I went into a meeting one day, and the manager, the global IT manager guy, he was talking about what he was going to do next. And I can't remember what he was talking about, but I took umbrage with what he said. I said, no, you're talking rubbish. And so basically I'm mid-flight, I'm talking about how what his plan is rubbish, and you know, I'm cocky 20 something year old, and I said, no, this is rubbish. Mid-sentence, the guy that pops into the room is the chief operations officer, and he Dr. Jack McGinley, and he's standing there, and he says, And he just kind of, he was quite a quiet guy, but he was a really, really clever guy. He's such an awesome guy. And so I'm mid-sentence, so I just carry on, keep on saying what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And basically saying that the boss's idea was rubbish. Everybody files out of the room at the end of the meeting, including the IT manager. And just as I get up to leave, the COO says, Alistair, I'd like you to stay back a moment, would you please? And I'm like, oh my goodness, I have lost my job, man. That is it. I have really screwed up. I've screwed the pooch. And he said, to my amazement, he said, Alistair, I would like you to be the IT manager, the global IT manager. I'm like, what? I'm a Unix,
yeah,
Unix admin guy. Like, and he said, yeah, don't worry about that. And I said, well, what about the IT manager? And he said, oh, yeah, don't worry about him either. And I said, I don't know anything about management at all. It's literally, you know, I've been in technical leadership, I guess, but not really any IT management. And so, yeah, here I was probably 25, something like that. I was not old. And I had an opportunity there that I could either say no to, because I had no idea in my right mind. I was like, I've got no idea. But I spoke to my father, and he said, you know, you're always going to, and this is the one of these things that I've always remembered from my father, and he said, you're always going to regret this if you don't take this opportunity.
Yeah, you'll think back on it. And so what did I turn down when I, yeah.
Yeah. So if I had turned that down, I know today that my career path would have worked out extremely differently. Because that one choice there to say yes the day after, I said, can I sleep on it? And he said, yes. Oh, if I had turned him down at that point, then my career path would have taken a very different path. And, you know, it could have been good. but it could have been not so good. Who knows? But the path that I've taken since then, basically, it led me into in a really, really, I guess, fortunate way. And it's just, you know, it's one of those things that comes along in your life and you just go, there's something I didn't expect. Yeah. And I think in everybody's lives, you might not realize it at the time, but whether it's your career or whether it's your personal life or something like that, something comes along and it's not what you expect. And I think nowadays I'm more likely to step back and evaluate what's being presented, because I really can't explain it now. I mean, here I am a lot older now, and I think about these things a lot more. And I'm going, this is crazy. How do these opportunities appear, and how do you get into them? And it's very difficult to actually put them into words. It's really, well, really strange.
I mean, so you're absolutely right. Some of them are happenstance. I mean, so people would say, "Oh, it was luck, Alistair. Mm. You lucked into that role." But I would challenge that and say, "Yeah, okay, luck, but you were prepared to the point. I mean, you couldn't step up in that." And by the way, I have a similar story where I stood up in a meeting and began spouting off, and that ended up in me suddenly changing career paths and roles after 22 years. You were prepared to stand up and talk through what you thought was the right path for the company to go. Mm. So you had your entire life up to that point had been preparing your knowledge base, which wasn't just, so I've done sysadmin. I've known a lot of sysadmins. You can do the entire sysadmin role without understanding the way an enterprise works. Mm. You can maintain and run Unix servers, Linux servers, Windows servers. You can be the system administrator for them and never touch the network, never touch databases, never touch an understanding of how enterprise IT works. Mm. To stand up and have a discussion means that you paid attention and had some thought around how everything else worked. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to stand up and make that comment.
Yeah.
And so it was absolutely luck, but I do think that there, and this is back to, you know, our recommendation to people who find themselves in this position is it's okay, you know, it's okay to turn something down, and it's okay to think through something, but don't automatically assume that if you can't 100% do something, mm-hmm. that you should turn it down. I mean, stretch yourself, try. You wouldn't be being offered something if somebody didn't see some capability to be able to do it. It would be much better for you to be offered something and you take it that you don't think you're capable of doing and fail than to, you know, say, well, no, I'm not 100% there, and stay where you are and never grow out beyond the position. It would be better in the long run for you to try and fail and learn and see if you liked it, if you didn't like it. The number of stories of people in IT that I know that tried something and they didn't keep doing it because they failed, but because they just didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And they learned that they didn't like management, or they learned that they didn't like, you know, having to deal with the business side, or they learned that they didn't like architecture, and so they went back into engineering, is much greater than the ones that tried to do architecture or that tried to go into management and just couldn't succeed.
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right, Sean. The ability to just... Well, there's two things, really. There's fake it till you make it,
yep.
And there's failing fast. And I think you've hit on both of those items there. So failing fast really is the ability to go, you know what, I've messed up something here,
yep.
But then go, all right, well, so what? Let's pivot. Let's try something else.
Yep.
And the other one is fake it till you make it. And I'll come back to fake it till you make it. But failing fast was... literally what I did for the next decade, I would say. I mean, maybe less than a decade, but not much. So in that role, in that first IT management role in Scotland there, I literally had a team of IT engineers who I already knew, which I found quite difficult, actually, because I kind of befriended these people. And that was like almost lesson number one. Lesson number one was about saying, well, now I'm their manager. I'm responsible for all aspects, like their salaries, yeah. You know, their foibles.
Whether
their
they
issues
succeed. That, yeah, whether they succeed or not.
So it's a totally different area. Yeah. And so I started
it's
to find out.
It's a hard pivot. It's a very hard pivot.
So I found myself being responsible for all of that, and ultimately finding out that I could not be friends with these people, not in the same way, at least not in the, yeah. The dynamic was not ever going to be the same. So I could no longer be necessarily a close friend. That was in all case but one guy. I brought him out to New Zealand many years later, and he's now a very successful cybersecurity guy, so that's great. But anyway, I think, you know, the aspect of learning all of these things, I literally had no knowledge. I bought managing for dummies, and you know, I'm not afraid to say that now, although at the time I was probably bricking it. And I was really, really, you know, if I told anybody that I've got managers for dummies, then I think like I would have died with, you know, bad. But you know, I think it was really something that over the next few years, I think it was two and a half years I was in that role, I learned as a baptism of fire. I'd make some mistakes. And at the end, I started going, you know what? I'm not afraid of making mistakes. And I started to embrace them, because I started to think back to the beginning of this story, which I've told you. And remember when I told you when I was a kid and I'd learn by breaking things on the computers, you know, so I'd, you know, whether it be smashing the password file on the system at the college, whether it was, you know, writing over the master boot record in the DOS PC of my dad, getting a virus on my machine, you know, all of that stuff. Like, I really screwed a whole bunch of stuff. And whether I knew it or didn't know it at the time, the whole thing is that I broke things, but then because they were broken and I was, you know, I wanted to fix them, I wanted to get back to how, you know, and there was so many things that I broke in IT. But I broke them under semi-controlled circumstances when I grew up a little. But when I started understanding that I'd broken all of these things, I could fix them again. And once I could fix them, I learned that this continual cycle of fix, break, I could do that at home, do it on my own time. And then I could actually start to put similar kind of things in safe constructs into my management career. I'd say, right, okay, team, what about doing this? You know, let's take all the feedback in from the whole team and try and work through a solution and be okay to embrace failure as a whole team, you know. And that was really powerful. All of a sudden, we were all winning at whatever we were doing. We'd go and say, well, okay, that didn't work, but no problem. Let's just move on to the next thing. Let's try it another way. And we had a really happy team, and it was a really great job. It was a really great position. Unfortunately, the company, this little thing called the iPhone came out, and all of a sudden, Office software from Microsoft appeared, and before long, the company wasn't doing so well. So it was time to move on, and then I got an opportunity. Again, because of that company crashing the way it did, I don't know if I would have gone to New Zealand. So again, there was an opportunity. I said to my wife at the time, I said, hey, what next? And she said, oh, here, New Zealand's all right. It's kind of hot and sunny over there. I was like, is it? That was a lie. But, you know, there was a few other things, you know, apparently it was nice and the people were nice and all these sorts of other things.
Hot and sunny compared to Scotland.
Yeah, true, true. I mean, anything above 0 degrees, right? So, you know, I literally took a leap of faith there, sold the house, sold the car, and came over here with no job. And again, it's like one of those pivotal opportunities. Like, what if I didn't do that? I would be kind of a bit miserable thinking about what to do next in Scotland. And, you know, okay, I'm sure it would have worked out okay in the end, but it was a really good opportunity. And I would have always gone, what if I'd have gone to New Zealand? So that was great. I got here and I had an opportunity to work at Manukau Institute of Technology eventually, and then onto Foodstuffs. And then I pivoted again slightly and went to work for a company called Cyclone Computer Company. And there I took a different sort of role. I was a leadership role, but I was also working in a position of business development, basically. And I had built a portfolio of products. We were one of the very first managed services companies to do AWS, for example. So I built built a product based on AWS, which was really cool. And so all these sorts of roles, you know, it really got good fun. And it was all, they're always different in some way, really pushing me in some different way. And all the time, like, for example, when I was at Manukau Institute of Technology, I made a project there to be one of the first in New Zealand, I believe, to provide a bring your own device campus. And so we had to completely refactor the infrastructure there. All of the network had to be basically gutted and started again. Brand new wireless. Now, we had to do so many clever things to make sure the wireless was blends seamlessly from one part of the campus to the next. You could take your iPad and your laptop and it would just work anywhere you were on campus. But it was also really important that all of the security aspects were very carefully, you know, thought out. And so I was using, again, my security capabilities from my systems roles that I had before and my networking skills. So I brought them all in. And whilst I was leading this project, you know, I was still going, right, okay, how should we be thinking about security? So I was empowering the team to do the security work, but also using my past technical knowledge to ask the questions of the team. So it was really good to do that. And then the next company I went to work for, basically they had a number of opportunities in there. I ended up having about four hats on, but one of the hats was Chief Information Security Officer. And again, that was kind of like, what are we doing with security? Let's get serious here about security. And so that was why I ended up in that role. And it really grew my love of all things security. I've always done it at home. I've always had a lab at home and always played with things, Kali Linux. Why I've got a box behind me, which is the Wi-Fi pineapple. You know, I've always got stuff that I'm playing with, whatever it is, in the lab at home. But I guess it was a good opportunity for me to take what I had in a technical capability, but also in a governance capability, and meld the two together. So I really enjoyed that. Then the next thing I got was to take that into a more commercial experience. And work for the company where you and I met, Sean, which is now called Cognizant. And I got to take another bit of my previous skill from my management at Cyclone there, which was about building business development. And so I basically had a little incubator for a business there to start up a cybersecurity business inside that Cognizant company. So that was really fun because it was something that I hadn't had the ability to start up a business of my own before, not in the same way anyway.
And it gave you a safe space and a couple, you know, because I did the same thing with AI within Cognizant in New Zealand, but it gave you a safe space and it gave you resources that you could use to help you move along in the path.
So I certainly didn't have that amount of money to just go off and run a business here in New Zealand before. So this was basically providing IT services, infrastructure, security services to clients in a way that, you know, basically start up and run it as if it was a brand new business, but with the big name behind it. So that was a lot of fun. And I think that was, at that point, it was time to make a brave decision. Again, it was one of these points where I'd been thinking about running my own business for many years, and I just didn't have quite the cash flow. And a number of people came to me and said, hey, Alistair, I don't understand why you don't run your own business. And I said, I would love to run my own business, but I don't have the cash flow, really. It's not, I can't completely give it. I want to give it 100%. And the only way I can give it 100% is by having enough money in the bank.
It can't be a side job. And for people who haven't started their own business, you either have to have a revenue stream from existing clients, or you have to have enough of an investment community chest bank role to be able to run for a period of time. It's from what I've seen from those who've done it, it's really exciting and you can really enjoy it and you get to be your own boss and chart your own path. But you need to have a plan going into it.
You do. And I've always kind of had the plan. I just haven't had the cash. I had some of the cash. I knew I wouldn't have enough cash to make it last. And I would always be really worried, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to build a team of people and make it a proper company, like I was doing for Cognizant. So I kind of thought that was as far as I was going to get. I was always going to be working in a role. Okay, it was a senior role, but it was, you know, it's always going to be working for the man, you know? And so I was thinking at this point in time about going and living in Australia and just giving that a shot. So I booked myself some tickets. I was scheduled to fly out at Christmas, and this was last Christmas. So this is Christmas 2022.
Yep.
I bought the tickets, I don't know, maybe July or something like that.
And then a
couple of people came to me and said to me, look, man, I think you should really do this business. You should really do it. And I said, yeah, okay. And they said, here's some cash.
Yep.
So I put my money together, their money together, and here I am now running my own business, and a cybersecurity business. And again, there's at least three occasions now where I've said in this story where I've been given this opportunity somehow, and there I am, and it's just sort of, if I didn't take it, what would my life look like? And even if I ultimately fail in this business or not, I mean, I'm very hopeful that I succeed. I mean, certainly nobody starts out, but business is, you know, it's a tough endeavor to make it all work. And I think that's, again, I'm now reflecting at this point in my life going, well, hold on, you know, I've been given, you know, major opportunities here somehow. And when I said earlier on about fail fast, that has worked, and it's worked time and time again. But also I said, fake it till you make it. And I think that's another thing. I've never been in a position where I would say I know absolutely everything about everything. And some of the times what you need to do is just know enough, enough to get started. So I didn't know anything pretty much about management, but I just about knew enough. I had confidence in that I knew technically what was required, and I knew what the technical members were required to do. And all I needed to do was somehow make sure that I didn't screw it up for those guys and girls to do their job.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so everybody could just keep on going with the company and not screw things up. Because, you know, things like some of the staff were pretty upset with some of the things that the manager was doing at the time. And so I thought, well, if I can just do 1% better than what's happening here, then that will be a success. So I think that's it. I just knew just enough to get there. And then I said, yep, okay, I'll do this and I'll give it everything I've got. And you try and you try and you try, and you just push yourself just that little bit better, every further, every single time. And yes, okay, so I didn't know 100%, but nobody does. Even when the people who say they know 100%, they don't. So
So this is two sides of a coin. And there's the secondary aspect to this is something that I think everybody needs to understand. The one side of the coin is faking it till you make it. It's the actions that you choose to do and how you present yourself to the world. The result of that is the other side of the coin, which is imposter syndrome.
Mm.
And I'm here to tell you, after, you know, almost 30 years in IT, Alistair with, you know, 25 years in IT, that even today with areas that I consider myself to be an expert in, I still have imposter syndrome. Mm. I have stood up on a stage talking about things that I absolutely knew that I knew the answers for, and I still felt like I was an imposter. I've heard the CEO of Atlassian Compute talk about the fact that he wakes up in the morning or sometimes in the middle of the night with anxiety around imposter syndrome, feeling like you are an imposter and you aren't capable of doing what it is that you're doing is a natural feeling. You are going to feel that. And in fact, I would almost hesitate to say that if you're not feeling that, you're not pushing yourself enough.
Or you're too cocky and you're setting yourself up for a failure.
Oh, so we could go down the path of X level developers, but yeah, that's a whole other story. But for the vast majority of us, it's okay to feel a little uncomfortable. It's okay to try and fail. It's okay to fake it until you make it. I will say that there was a time in the early 2000s where someone that worked for me came to me one day and he said, Sean, I finally figured you out. And Alistair, I think I've told you this story before, but he goes, I think I've figured you out. And I said, great. Cause I don't completely understand me. So let's have it. Tell me what it is cause I don't know me enough. And he goes, you talk so authoritatively and you're right often enough that you get away with it. And I remember at the time, I know what I thought at the time, and jokingly at the time, I said, well, if I'm right often enough, shouldn't I speak authoritatively about what I'm talking about? But I've had a lot of time to review over that. I mean, almost 20 years, because that's how long ago that was when that happened. And it's true. There's a flip side of it. I talk authoritatively about what I believe is the right answer, but I'm willing to accept when it's wrong. So if somebody comes to me, like I've had interns that work for me, Caleb, Aaron, Misa, you guys know this. Awesome. I will go in and have an opinion about something. And if somebody, even, you know, an intern right out of school brings me something and says, no, I think you're wrong, Sean, and here's why. I can accept that and I can change how you go forward. So you don't have to be arrogant about it when you're faking it till you make it and try and back yourself into a corner where you can't get out of it. It's okay to have an opinion and think that you're right. And it's okay to accept when you're wrong and to change that opinion. And I think that really shows the strength. And Alistair, you do the exact same thing. I've seen you in meetings where you walked in think, you know, you knew that you knew the right answer. And when we get Kevin Johnson on the podcast, eventually he will probably tell the story of me pounding on a table, which is another story. But you thought you knew the answer and you went in and somebody walked you through why your opinion was wrong. And I've seen you accept it. And I think that's what makes you a great executive level leader. A leader, not a manager, a leader that leads people, because you have an opinion and it's a fact-based opinion, but you're willing to change it if somebody comes and talks you through it and gives you a better understanding.
I think certainly being humble is a really important aspect to you know, your life in general. It's not just a professional thing. You know, take criticism, take compliments, and don't just throw them away either way. So if it's a criticism, thank the person for pointing out what they've discovered, because we all get things wrong. All of us, absolutely every one of us.
That's so right.
Be humble and take that and thank that person for it.
Steve Jobs said that no one would ever buy an iPhone. There was no reason why he should develop an iPhone for Apple, because that would never be a product. People didn't want to listen to music on their phone. They didn't want to do things on their phone. He wanted to develop an iPod that could bring music to them. And he had to be talked into building the iPhone, the first iPhone. So everybody can be wrong. And so that goes along with that imposter syndrome. Just because you have a wrong opinion, just because you think one way and it's not correct, does not make you an imposter. It makes you human. It means that you have cognitive biases, you have that may have drawn you down a path where you misunderstood something, but that's completely okay. That's what makes us good at what we do. And being able to accept that and learn from that and move on, I think is really a superpower that you have, Alistair. And having been working with you for, my God, is it almost 3 years now?
I think so.
Yeah, almost 3 years. Yeah, my God. But yeah, I think it's one of your superpowers. And I really do. I think it's so it is really.
Thank you, Sean. Saying I'll take compliments and thank people for them. You know, that's important. But thank you, Sean. I really appreciate that.
But I think, you know, your approach to failing fast, your approach to faking it till you make it and you know, being humble within the leadership roles that you're in, I think has been really good for your career. And I think that's what, again, going back to that, hey, you have this lucky opportunity to go do this thing. I think the reason you got there was because of all of these prep things that got you to it. And and by the way, I've turned that same lens on my own career, and I think that I'm where I am right now because of very similar things. And at the time, I may have thought, oh, I have no choice. I have to do this, or, you know, I'm being backed into a corner. But the reality is that I got there not because of happenstance, but because of everything that came before there. And so I think it's a great story. I think for those of you that are listening, remember, this podcast is about demystifying. So we've kind of demystified Alistair's journey through his career and where he had choices to make and how he, whether he consciously did it or unconsciously did it, made the choices he made to get him where he is. And I would say, you know, take opportunities, take chances, stretch yourself, aim for something that you might not think you're all the way there. We had a really great discussion with Amanda Watson. And one of the things that she brought up in Women in Tech, which we linked from last fortnight's podcast, was this idea that a woman will look at a job description, and if she doesn't meet 100% of the requirements, she won't apply for it. Whereas, you know, statistically, a man, if he meets, I think the number she said was like 10%, but there's some percentage if the man's willing to accept that he doesn't know, meet every requirement on it, he'll still apply for the job. And I think that, you know, try for it, go for it. I would encourage anybody to try and go for a job.
Yep. Because what's the worst that can happen? Again, flipping it on its head, what is the worst that can happen?
Yep.
They can say no. All right, cool. Yep. Just try again.
Well, and, you know, that might not be the worst thing. That might be a bad thing. The worst thing might be that you get it and then you fail at the job.
Yeah.
But it's not so bad an outcome. If you fail and learn that one is not the job you're, you know, currently skilled up to do, that's a learning experience. Mm-hmm. You may find that you really like the job, even though you don't have the skills. So then you know the skills you need to go get so you can come back and be successful at the job. You may find that you don't like the job. And then that's a learning experience where you can say, hey, I don't want to go into management. I want to stay in a technical path. I want to stay focused on an individual contributor role within a wider team. There's no worst case scenario that means, you know, you're going to ruin your entire career because you took a shot at a job.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So look, it's been about almost an hour, so I don't want to bore you with any more of the story, but I'm hopeful that the story has shown you that there's lots of different pathways in to getting a role in IT and just in any case, in any role, in fact. And there's lots of, it's totally acceptable to make mistakes, to get things wrong, to try again, but basically what I'm saying is take those opportunities, try your best. And if you don't succeed at first, then try again and you'll get there in the end.
So thank you for listening to Technology Whispers. Alistair, look, thank you for being so vulnerable and opening up about your journey. I mean, I know some of it probably wasn't as comfortable as it sounds on the call, on the podcast. So I really appreciate you putting yourself out there like this and kind of walking us through that journey.
Thanks, Sean.
As always, if you have any ideas or any suggestions, we have some great guests coming up in the upcoming podcasts. If you have a podcast idea, if you want to be a guest, reach out to us. Both Alistair and I love to talk to people online about this podcast and bringing you along on the journey. Alistair, how can people find you on the web?
You can get me on my business is Revolution at InfoSec. So you can get me revolutionatinfosec.com. You can also get me on LinkedIn, just search for Alistair Ross. And I'm on YouTube as well. Yeah, check me out there. I've got a channel for Revolution InfoSec, and I've also got a geeky channel called Al's Geek Lab.
Yeah, the YouTube algorithm that transcribes that doesn't know how to handle his Scottish
accent. It's a totally different translation. Yeah. Yeah. YouTube does not like Scottish.
If you want to reach out to me, it's Sean G. Muller. I'm on the Instagrams, the X, which used to be Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. I'm available online. Reach out to me. Other than that, everyone have a very good day.
Thanks for listening. Cheers.